100 years ago when we had ongoing agricultural operations and much land had been cleared for orchards, et cetera. Where I live, you know, was pears. And I know other people where they lived, it was apples or whatever. You know, their land was cleared. There were no trees on my lot when we bought it 28 years ago. We now have hundreds of trees on our lot. And many of them would fall under this ordinance if it was applicable to single family properties. Same with my neighbors, they had no trees, they have hundreds, you know, hundreds of trees. I don't understand what it is we're trying to protect against. The vast majority of people, businesses, and organizations value trees. That's why they plant them. That's why homeowners plant them. That's why there's more now than there used to be. And frankly, I was on the city council when we first passed a tree ordinance and I voted against it because I didn't understand what the problem was we were proposing this solution for. And what I see here is, and I was, you know, a very much of an advocate of changing the ordinance back in 2018, and we did streamline it, not completely to my satisfaction, but it was a significant step forward to lessen the number of items that would come forward, take up staff time, stake up planning commission time, cost property owners a lot of money. We did streamline it, but now we end up with a situation like this where a nonprofit organization had to pay a professional arborist to go, yeah, that's dead, you know, and then pay a substantial fee to the city to process this and end up with a report before the city council. And I don't understand what it is we're accomplishing with the tree ordinance at all. I don't know how many tree removals have we ever declined, either you at the staff level or at planning commission or council? Do you know of any we've ever said, no, you can't do that to? In your, because you've been here like 15 years, Mr. Dunsmore, or so, right?
I do not recall ever declining a tree removal.
Right. And I mean, we do when we have a significant development, we require a landscape plan, correct? For people to, like if somebody's building a shopping center, we make them have a landscape plan for planting trees and other things. I mean, I'm more concerned that we don't want to do anything. And so, you know, we wait till trees, big trees die and then we have a big hole. I'd be more concerned that we have a tree replacement plan and that some of the big sycamores on Atascadero Avenue, it would be good to maybe some of them come down and be replaced so that when they fall, there's not a big hole. When they die, there's not a big hole. And I just don't see the benefit of placing this burden on property owners. This case illustrates it, where you have a community nonprofit doing great things for the community, and we're just, you know, sucking a lot of money out of their small wallet for this purpose. But the same logic applies to other property owners, commercial property owners. I remember when I was on the planning commission visiting Rancho Del Bordo, you know, mobile home park, to look at a tree that was, you know, about 6 inches around, obviously dead, could have been cut down, you know, with a chainsaw in a few minutes and hauled away in 30. And we required them to pay an arborist, pay for a report to the planning commission. We changed some of that in 2018, but we're imposing a solution on a non-problem in my eyes. And so I would certainly look to make some of the changes that Councilmember Funk alluded to. But for me, I would look at revamping the whole thing. And why do we even do this? I'm not sure what, if anything, we're accomplishing for the community. I don't see that we're accomplishing anything in real protection, you know, in terms of what isn't already happening. So those are my thoughts. I would like us to relook the whole dang thing at some point in the near future, but in the near term, to at least provide some guidance that we'd like to see, the default being you don't need a arborist report unless you determine an arborist report is needed. And your default is you guys look at it first, because I just hate to impose this expense and time on property owners for what I just don't see as a problem. We don't have people running around cutting down trees willy-nilly. We don't have people asking to cut down trees willy-nilly, because most people value trees. Almost all people value trees, all businesses and all organizations. They almost all value trees. They enhance their property values. They enhance the functionality of their property. And we don't need to make a big, you know, have a 17-page ordinance about it. So sorry I'm rambling, but I'll start on my left, see if you have any other comments, and then we'll discuss a motion.
Yeah, at the very least, I think it that we shouldn't charge to have somebody remove a dead tree. At the very least, I think charging somebody to be evaluated, then they got to hire the person to cut it down. That's the very least that I just don't understand why we have that. I remember before I was on council, I had a friend who had to pay a fee to get a tree removed, and he was going on about it, and it didn't make sense to me then. It wasn't something the hill I was going to die on right when I came into the office, but I do think it's time to do some sort of change there. We have a, I'm not going to go on and on. I agree with most of what Mayor Barbeau said. We do have many, 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 many trees, and nobody wants to cut down their trees. I think in the 15 years I've lived here, the biggest tree scandal was Justin cutting down their trees for their vineyard. I haven't heard of anything like that anywhere around here, or Tree City USA designation. They're beautiful, but I think that it's a public perception that you're not allowed to cut your trees down too. I mean, as a realtor, I sell houses and people don't want to live here because like, I can't cut a tree down in Atascadero. It's a rumor that people believe, and I think it's for a good reason. You know, you don't want to cut down a bunch of trees, but I think it's one of those things where even in certain areas, since I've lived here, the trees are double, triple the size in 15 years, and ones that weren't there are there. And I just think it's a lot to do about nothing, in my opinion. And I also just had one follow-up question. When was the last time we had to do a heritage tree replacement?
Probably Sylvester's.
Last time was about 3 years ago, right next door to this property.
Okay, so it's not an ongoing issue where everybody's trying to cut down their heritage trees.
Very rare.
Yeah, I just think it's time to revamp it. And at the very least, I do see the because I was asking that question because if you forgive a fee to one organization that paid it, you have someone in the past, recent past, that says, well, what about me? It was only 2 years ago I paid the same amount of money. So I do see that as being a problematic if we're going to go back and reimburse individuals and organizations where just recently somebody else had paid it. Who's to say they're not going to come, and now there's precedent that they're going to get their money back, you know? So I think we should be careful with how that is done if that's decided upon. But bottom line is I'd like to do away with make this thing one paragraph.
Do you want to just add a point of clarification? As I've looked at the ordinance a little bit more closely before you tonight, while the arborist report shall be provided as deemed necessary by the community development director, the way the ordinance is currently written is that a required finding for a tree removal when the tree is dead, deceased, or injured beyond reclamation is that the tree is dead, diseased, or injured beyond reclamation as certified by a tree condition report from an arborist. So those two provisions read together for the specific purposes of removing a dead tree would still require an arborist report. So if you are interested in removing that requirement, I would recommend directing staff to do so with an amendment to the code.
What I'd recommend, if I can jump in, because we could get into this all night and we're not prepared to do that. So I think if there's the will of the council to tell the staff, yeah, we're not feeling great about the tree ordinance as it is, it's heavy-handed. Staff, can you come back quickly with thoughts? We generally hear you, but if each of you could share with me general themes, I could have a staff report brought back to you that addresses some of those themes and maybe the unintended consequences that you can just see, and then things you could consider. You could direct us then on the way you want to improve the tree ordinance. We could bring it back, you know, a meeting or two later. I think that'd be more efficient than us trying to do something without it in front of us.
Right. Yeah, we don't want to make the sausage. I think our intention is clear, at least regarding that specific question regarding arborist reports. But I think without burdening you too much in the short term, I think we do want to have a further, more lengthy discussion about the ordinance itself. But in the short term, yeah, you know, address the specific language that you don't need an arborist to tell you the tree is dead.
Would you be okay with that coming back in October? We could probably, we don't have much on the meetings then. Is that something you'd be interested in discussing then, or?
I think that would be fine. I think that'd be fine. I don't see foresee any other heritage trees, you know,
okay,
dying before then and needing to be removed. okay, so Mayor Pro Tem Daris.
Just a couple of comments. Well, on the need for an arborist report, I think it is going to be important at times to for one to be presented, because it could be one side says it's dying, the other side says it's not. I think it needs to be certified whether it is or not. So, but requiring it in every situation may be a little excessive. But I wanted to also say that I agree with what the mayor was saying earlier, and on the tree removal permit, if there was an abuse of the right to remove a tree and it was constantly ongoing and we needed to feel like we needed to regulate that, I can see where a tree removal permit would be necessary. But as we've already, I think we all kind of agree that people aren't rushing to cut down trees on their property because it provides shade. I mean, were you outside today? It was nice and hot, and the shade was it was very welcoming. So it's not a problem with tree removal. So I think it does need to be looked into, and I appreciate the discussion that's happening here this evening. That's all I got. Thank you.
Councilmember Funk.
Yes, I think it's, we have an ordinance now that was aimed at making sure that unscrupulous developers don't go whacking down the, you know, largest, most beautiful trees that are a heritage of the entire community. It would clearly does, and maybe it's worked and maybe we don't, maybe it's already served its purpose and we don't need it anymore at all. We need to evaluate that. In the meantime, it's not meant, it shouldn't be meant for dead trees. This doesn't make any sense to me at all that we would charge somebody because their tree died. Okay, so we need to, and since we are retrospectively approving this situation because the tree was a hazard, that is what prevented this council from having the opportunity to waive this prospectively, we love the senior center and it's doing great work, but the issue here is it was a dead tree. And that's why we need to get them their money back in a fashion that will satisfy the needs of the city attorney. However that needs to happen, the money needs to be handled in that way, as far as I'm concerned. I also think, join my colleagues in saying the default position should be of this, we need a change so that the default situation is that no arborist report is necessary unless staff deems it important. If we're gonna do this, if your average fifth grader can tell it's a dead tree, you ought to be able to roll with that. Unless there's some reason that we have to know why it died or, you know, what it does. And then I would like to see us have that larger discussion about the tree ordinance and in general, the strategy for how we're dealing with the, we've got a handful, maybe a dozen really special trees that are sort of a treasure of the whole community, and that we need to think about the generational replacement of those trees, much as this council has had to address that with those treasured trees that are in the sunken gardens. We've had to deal with that with the Deodar cedars, and with one of the magnolias already in my time on the council. Stuff gets old, and we have to work with that. So we should be looking for these long-lived trees when we have that further discussion. I do want to have a discussion with the community that where we look at the kinds of trees that will hold up best over the next 100, 150 years, that we're hoping that those trees will last so that our grandchildren, can enjoy the same kind of beauty that we have and a beauty that will work for their situation. So that's my piece. So I'm looking at a quick fix piece on, on this, and then a larger discussion that would happen later, part of, this, do we need this, and what's the strategy? We should probably consider that in terms of all the sunken garden trees as well, so that we're looking generationally.
Okay, thank you. Councilmember Newsom, any comments?
I just want us to address the financial aspects of the tree ordinance as it pertains to the tree that's dying. So I think all of us are in agreement.
Okay, I'm going to suggest that, and I'll go ahead and make the motion, that we adopt the draft resolution to approve the retroactively approve the removal.
Pardon, Mayor, can you please, if you are going to move towards a motion, I would recommend closing the public hearing.
Oh, okay.
Prior to doing so.
Well, I thought we already closed the public comment portion.
It's a public comment, but this is a public hearing item, so we would close the public hearing.
Okay, so we've closed the public hearing then, and we'll move on to council. Well, now we've had discussion, we'll move into motion. I would move that we adopt the draft resolution to retroactively allow the removal of the oak, of course. I think we have a consensus as part of that motion to encourage the staff to determine if there is a legal way to refund the fee paid by the senior center. And however it is you find necessary to word that, characterize that, whatever that the council wishes to see that happen as part of the motion. We want you to address the specific issue regarding the requirement of an arborist report, but we want to have a further substantive discussion about the tree ordinance itself. So.
And I want to clarify whether your motion includes the modification to condition number 4, as recommended by staff, to replace the tree within 1 year.
Yes, we do want to see them replace the tree and to do so within
one year.
You. And staff allowed in this recommended allowing this particular case a smaller replacement that would normally be required for a heritage tree, and we understand that and endorse that as part of the it's in the resolution or in the conditions. And so, yes, the motion includes the modification of this condition. Okay.
I'd be happy to second that motion.
I just want to point a clarification. If we're going to refund the fee, I don't want to charge anybody ever again. We're not going to refund a fee and then 2 months from now charge somebody else a fee. So I don't know if we can wrap that up in there. Does that not sound like it would be kind of sticky if we did that?
Yes. We don't see these very often, so I'm very hopeful I can work with staff with the capacity we have to get an ordinance back to you, making that very clear so it's clear in the law what I'm doing. And so this will be a priority to us to try and turn it around, and hopefully we don't have one of these. If we do, I'll talk with the city attorney about ways we can do it, but the council has made it very clear. And so
if it does come up, we'd have the opportunity to keep it from being from being charged.
I think you are making your legislative intent clear.
Okay.
Leave it to me to figure out how we do that.
Perfect.
That's what
Thank
I would
you.
Be comfortable with. So I think what you've said is, one, you're approving the staff recommendation. Two, you want us to bring back a review of the ordinance that focuses on getting rid of the arborist, dead trees, the fees, and the concept of the ordinance at all. And three, that I'm working with the authority I have to reimburse the monies paid. That's what I think this motion is, right?
Correct. That you find a way to do that, and our intention is to not charge it again, but that certainly in this specific case you find a legal avenue to reimburse the fee.
Yeah, and that's specific to dead trees. We don't charge anything for dead trees.
Right. Yeah, we shouldn't charge anybody a fee to take down a dead tree. So
yes, that's clear, and we do have a motion and second.
Okay.
On that.
Okay, if that's clear to staff, then we'll go ahead and proceed to roll call.
Councilmember Funk?
Yes.
Councilmember Newsom?
Yes.
Councilmember Peak?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Daris?
Yes.
Mayor Bourbeau?
Yes.
Motion passes.
All right, thank you. And thank you for attending and providing your input on this item. We're going to proceed on to item G2, annual military equipment report. I'm going to turn this over to the police chief, Chief Suttles.
Mr. Mayor, City Council, thank you very much. Let me get this up and running here real quick. As there a way to turn it on, everybody? Okay. All right, I'll start off by giving a little bit of background. In September 2021, the state of California passed Assembly Bill 481, which essentially required law enforcement agencies to adopt a military equipment list. And then in September 2022, City Council here also passed an ordinance that required staff to return annually to give a report on such things as the... Thank you very much. Okay. So the report will include things such as the quantity of items possessed, the initial cost of those items, and the results of an internal audit. So tonight, we are staff is here and recommends that one, we approve the 2026 annual military equipment report. We adopt the updated military equipment policy. Three, we approve the drone program. And four, we add a drone to the military list. And by doing so, if we were to do those same things, tonight's request would fulfill the statutory requirement while seeking approval also to establish a department's drone program. So I'll get right into the report. This is a summary of the report that we did. And essentially, the police department did an internal audit in which we determined there were no pilot policy violations. And this is specific to policy 708, which is the actual military equipment policy. There was also no complaints in this last year regarding our military equipment. And then also the equipment used was within policy, and that's pertaining regarding all policy. Additionally, one of the things that the report requires is that we go over what we currently have on our military list. And that is 43 patrol rifles. We have two precision rifles and four and nine 40 millimeter less than lethal launchers. I think it's important to note that none of this military equipment was actually utilized in the field. The only time any of our equipment were used during this last year was during training. So in addition to the report, that basically wraps up the report side of it. And in addition to the report, we're also recommending that we update policy 708, which is our military equipment policy, specifically policy section 708.6. The way it currently reads is that any agency that were to, law enforcement agency that were coming to our area to help us, to give us assistance, would not be able to use any of their own military equipment unless it was on our equipment list. And I don't think that was the initial intent. So we've clarified the language there to clean that up so that it'll indicate that it allows assisting agencies to operate their own approved military equipment within their own policies. This does not expand the Atascadero Police Department's authority to acquire or use military equipment. This just gives those other agencies the opportunity to use the equipment that they have approved through their own policies. And the reason why this is important, because if you can imagine that we're calling in another agency because there's something that we need their assistance with, sometimes that's because an incident was too large for us to be able to handle, and we're calling them to come in to help us, and they're going to bring equipment to do that. And we don't want to have to turn them away just because we didn't clarify this one section. So that concludes the first part of the presentation. The second part is the drone itself and our request to add it to the program. So why would we want to have a drone in the first place? Well, quite simply, it increases officer safety and it also increases our capabilities. As you can imagine, on the officer safety side of it, it's always safer to put a machine where instead into a place of danger other than a person. And then as far as capabilities, there's clearly things that a flying machine can do that a person cannot do. We can get better observation. We can do to help us with search and rescue, fire response, and even special events. So the drone that we are recommending is the DJI Matrix 4T. And the reason why we're specifically looking at this one is that it has thermal camera capabilities. It has a zoom camera capabilities. It has a laser rangefinder, which becomes important because if you're using that zoom or that thermal, it becomes very difficult to judge distance. And that will give us an idea to help us find missing persons, for example. It has obstacle avoidance, which would be ideal because we're going to be using these, we can potentially use these types of drones in tight quarters. So you want to have a mechanism that can protect itself. And it's designed specifically for public safety. And then also the cost, the entry cost to this particular drone is much more favorable than some of the other options out there. One of the things that was a major concern for the city council and also a major concern for our community was privacy. So this is something that we heard and we took very seriously. And we wrote into our policies and we wrote into our manuals. And I'm here to tell you that, we will not be using the drone for surveillance. We don't use the drone for random patrol. We will not weaponize the drone. What we will do is we will be constitutionally responsible with the drone and respect people's zone of privacy. So we respect this so much so that, again, we put it into our policies. We're following FAA regulations, and we put all this into our department, our operations manual as well. I think it's another point that I wanted to make is that our program includes more than 40 pages of policies, procedures, emergency protocols, training requirements, and operational safeguards. Again, I want to point out how serious we take this. Officer, for pilot and for observer requirements, all pilots and observers will be required to have training. The pilots specifically will have external training and then recurring internal training. As far as the program costs, there are four major areas. We have the cost of the drone and the accessories itself, the cost of storing the data, and then, of course, the cost of training and overtime. Together, those things I estimate at $60,416. And the estimated funding sources would be the City Council approved back in January 2026 a $26,000 general fund adjustment. So we use that $26,000 there. And then any other funds over that would come out of the existing supplemental law enforcement service fund. So again, to recap, we are asking City Council to approve the 2026 annual military equipment report, to adopt the updated military equipment policy, to approve the drone program, and to add a drone to the military list. With that, I will answer any questions.
Thank you, Chief. I'm going to start on my right this time. Councilmember Newsom, any questions?
Can you clarify what technology we're going to use for the drone program?
The technology, you mean what drone or?
The data storage. How is that handled?
We're going to have to buy, the reason why there's a cost to it is we have to buy a server that's going to be dedicated to storing this type of information. So some of the information, the data that we're going to be storing is the actual footage. We store all data for up to 180 days, or we store it for 180 days. If we determine that any data is related to a crime or a use of force, we'll mark that and we'll keep it for up to 2 years or until it's no longer needed, meaning that case has been adjudicated or something of that nature. So the need to store that data would be a server.
Okay, so to clarify, we're storing the data internally. We're not using a third-party system like Flock or any of that technology.
We're storing it internally.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Councilmember Funk.
Yes, following up on that comment, there's been a lot of confusion about this in Flock systems, and I see out there. Am I correct in understanding that this won't have any Flock camera, it won't be attached to any Flock camera, and we in the city of Atascadero don't use Flock cameras? Is that correct?
That's correct. All that is correct.
Okay, great. Thank you. And since this is going to be part of the military equipment manual list, will we be able to, this council will get a receiver report next year at the same process about the extent to which this is being used and how it's being used?
That's absolutely yes. Yes, correct.
Okay, great. Is there going to be any facial recognition technology that's part of this system?
We do not have that technology, no.
Okay. And I really appreciate the attention in this that we see in the staff report to prohibited uses so that it can't be used for surveillance and other kinds of things, and that seems, you know, or for targeted actions. Do you want to elaborate on that just a little bit?
Yeah, again, you know, one of our primary concerns is that we are constitutional. We understand the zone of privacy and what that means to people. So we wanted to have these safeguards put in place. We want to make sure that we codified that into our policies and that we were keeping that in mind.
Okay. So if the drone's flying along and it captures somebody's hot tub, whatever they're doing, that's not, is that something that would get stored or acted upon?
No, as a matter of fact, part of what is in our operating manual is to make sure that we're trying, the pilots are trained to make sure that they keep the cameras trained on the area of operation. So if they're going to be purposely keeping the camera out of people's yards, out of the windows, things of that nature.
Okay, so unless the criminal you're trying to arrest is hiding in the hot tub, you're not going to be getting pictures.
That's Got absolutely it. Correct.
Okay, so if ICE were to ask this department, come with a mutual aid request, asking the department to use this to do surveillance of, say, the Tamale Festival or a protest or something, is that something that the department would honor?
No, we wouldn't. There are California law that prohibits us from assisting ICE in any investigation. So in my opinion, that would fall under that. So we would not oblige that.
Okay. And could ICE try to get around that by submitting a public records request for some big swath of things so that they could troll it and look for brown faces?
No, they wouldn't be able to. We would have to take, you know, we would obviously have to address the public records request. It would be a little more of a longer answer, but the answer would still be no.
Okay. And if the APD or another partnering agency had an arrest warrant for a violent criminal that you're trying to execute, and that situation might be dangerous to the officers involved, or that might be someone who would flee and be a danger to the community. Is that a situation where the drone might be?
That's a great scenario for exactly why we'd want to have a drone. So yes, we would absolutely use it in that scenario.
Excellent. Thank you so much for clarifying those differences.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor Pro Tem Daris.
Thank you. I think you answered my first question was going to be on the data storage cost that I thought wasn't sure if that was like an annual fee. Thank God it's not.
Correct. It's not annual.
So it's a purchase of a device that's going to sort. So then my follow-up question that is, what is the capacity in whatever way that you can answer that? But because I'm thinking, you know, if you might not use this thing very often, but there might be a time when for whatever reason you're using it several times in a week or in the month, and you say you store the data for up to 180 days, what is the possibility that you could run out of storage, and then what do you do?
Well, we did an average of a high usage, moderate usage, and low usage, and so it's essentially where we ended up with, and this is, you know, talking with our IT manager, and we ended up going with a formula that used 50 gigabytes per flight hour up to 200 flight hours. It gave us the amount of space that we actually need, the amount of terabytes that we needed to be able to purchase, and then we wanted redundancy, so we had to double that. So that's basically the formula that we used to come up with it. Now, we used the moderate to high, so I doubt that we'll hit that ceiling, especially since we have that redundancy backup.
Okay. And I imagine it at first when we get this, it's probably not going to be used a lot. But as time goes on, you'll find more and more uses for it within the regulations, and there may be a need to purchase another storage device, I would imagine, because it's going to get used more and more over time. Yeah. How, I guess that's my question. So what is the lifespan that you're expecting of this storage device? In other words, when do you anticipate needing to purchase another one or a bigger one?
So the storage device itself, I'm anticipating to last through the program's life, for one drone, because that's what we're, that's the calculation that we're using. And the reason why is because, again, with our retention schedule, we're going to be dropping things off. I would say anywhere from 80 to 90% of the footage that's captured will be falling off after the first 180 days. And then the other 10 to 20% are those things that we've tagged that have been involved in one of the categories I described earlier. And those will fall off after 2 years or until, you know, we don't need it anymore. So that in that calculation, we're considering those percentages so that that particular data storage device should be able to last through the program, not just the life of that machine.
Okay. Now you had, there was a list on one of the slides that showed, I think it showed the uses that it's not going to be, no surveillance, all those different things. Now, are those just your policies, our policies, or is there federal regulations, state regulations that say you can't use this thing in certain ways? How are these policies created, or what are you bound by?
The policies are pretty universal. I think that if you went to any agency, you would find policies that are similar, simply because we understand that we're going, based off of the usage of other devices, such as tracking devices that we put on vehicles, we have to get a warrant for those types of things. So we understand that it's very sensitive, and we understand what the consequences of, you know, violating the trust of the community when it comes to privacy. So we don't want to lose this technology, so we're going to be very careful. So these maybe are not required, but we pretty much universally accept these.
And I think the catch-all that was in there was the constitutionally legal or whatever the word
yes.
was. So I think that's probably was answering my question, but in terms of what federal regulations are preventing you from using it a certain way, and I think that's the answer.
It is, and that goes back to a case law from 1964 that has just grown and grown and grown. You know, it started very simple. It's Connecticut versus Griswold, if anyone's interested. But it was about one particular item, and then over time, it's many different privacy zone issues. And so this is just the newest one so far.
Thank you. That's all I got.
Thank you. Councilmember Peak.
So this effectively works like a body cam. So when you're going after a crime, it turns on. The camera's not rolling, streaming on its way somewhere. It's not just live streaming whenever it's on and in the air.
Correct.
Okay. And that goes into evidence. It doesn't go into your computer, and then later you can just, it has to have documentation of when it was viewed, correct, or chain of command, like the data.
There's a procedure for storing the items in our storage. Mm-hmm. However, there is a difference between items that are stored and evidentiary items. Mm-hmm. So there will be a different process for storing evidence than the other, but they are all protected and monitored.
The first place my mind goes with one of these is fire spotting, you know.
Absolutely.
A brush fire starts, you can send it into the Santa Lucia Road and go look at the fire and determine, holy smokes, no pun intended, we need five engines. I don't really think about this another way, because I don't feel like we don't have, we have two cameras in town, one in the tunnel, and yeah, then one behind like Dr. Pramburn's office in the entire city. And I don't really like the idea of being a camera heavy town at all. I just want to get kind of like an idea of how readily available this will be for the fire agency. And if we have two officers that are trained to pilot the drone, then we're not covered on all shifts, correct? So the goal would be to have four pilots, correct?
That's correct. And we sent two officers to the school. We have officers who have already, just because they were either a couple, one guy's from the military, he brought an FAA 107 license, and another individual did it by hobby, so he has one. So we have four licensed pilots. Now they will have to go through our internal training as well, but we have the potential of four. The idea is that the drone lives with one of the watch, or with the watch commander. So in other words, it'll be in the field at all times. Mm-hmm. And then that'll be our goal, is to try to keep one of those pilots on each shift. Now, granted, that can sometimes become difficult, but that is our goal, to always have a pilot here.
And how much in the most recent past have we contracted a drone to be in town for special circumstances?
I'm sorry, what was the first part of the question?
Have we in the past, recent or distant past, I mean, not too distant, it's pretty new technology, contracted an agency to fly a drone in a task or be ready to fly one if we need one?
Right. We haven't signed any contracts or MOUs, but we have requested their assistance. We use them on special events. We use them on 4th of July. The special event I'm thinking of is the No Kings Day protest. We utilized a drone for surveillance there. It's a poor choice of words, but we used it to monitor the event as indicated in our slide. And then we also used it for an investigation where we had the county sheriff come up and help with a fatal car traffic collision.
And then when we do have this technology, how are we going to have a designated area where the public would know if and when it's just being that we're practicing? Like, where would we publish that they're practicing flying this drone and this is generally where it happens? And it's kind of like a common knowledge that if you're going to be practicing it, it's like Colony Park over the field. We're not practicing it in neighborhoods. We're not practicing it like chasing a cop car down the road. So I'm concerned with like the like when you're in the actual theater of like a crime, you know, what is people want to know the difference between if the crime's happening or if the cops are just practicing with the drone and when that would be known to the public.
Right. So there's a lot of difference in the use between somebody that's a hobbyist and then the police usage. But when we're training, we're going to stay within a lot of those FAA rules that indicate that you can't, you know, fly over personnel and you have to take all the precautions that you can. So exactly what you had mentioned, we're going to end up doing most of our practicing over areas that are not populated.
Okay.
Whereas during an emergent situation, then law enforcement agency, we would be flying over areas that could be populated. However, as far as publicizing those things, we didn't necessarily have a plan to do that, but we could certainly, you know, look at that.
So in terms of a question from Pismo Beach, do they have a similar program down there in Pismo Beach?
Gonna shake the dust out of my head. Which city did you say?
Pismo Beach.
Yes, we did. And
when you have photographers that are doing licensed FAA licensed drone pilots doing real estate photography, there's a different permitting process. So if somebody wanted to go photograph a property, they have to get a permit, which I don't think people generally do in Atascadero. Now, when the police agency now has a drone, is it going to be more? Are we going to be more strict with hobbyist or licensed photographers who are taking pictures of properties for sale? Or it's very common. Is it going to make it more challenging for someone who's doing it as a professional land surveyor or anything like that?
That hasn't been my experience, Chief. Did you?
Correct. I was basically going to say the same thing. It hasn't been my experience. We would still be call based. Today, if somebody called us, we would respond. That would be I don't see anything changing based off of this.
There wouldn't be any sort of more scrutiny on those other professions.
No, we're not involved in that now. We're just more, our scrutiny is on ourselves to make sure there's public confidence in when this is deployed and how it's deployed and that we're very transparent about how we use it.
All right, thank you. I have a couple questions, but I see members of the audience wanting to speak, checking their watches. So I'm going to open it up to public comment now, and then I'll ask my questions. So if anybody would like to speak on this item, please approach the podium. Thank you for your patience.
There'll be a red light.
Ah, I got it. Hi, I'm Jess Davis. I didn't expect to show up tonight, and I have no idea what I'm doing in case my entrance didn't give that away. Thank goodness for the angel that gave me this thing. So you're all subject to my ADHD ramblings about this, but I don't have any thoughts. I have a ton of questions. You know, like I remember my grandmother saying that like social security numbers were never supposed to be used as identification, but it's like the prime way that we identify people now. And I think about like, you say that it won't be used for surveillance, but then if it's tagged as like part of a crime, then you'll save it. But like, why would you have footage that wasn't part of a crime if it was only like called out when there was a crime? And then I wonder about like, it's terrifying to me. And like, as a software developer, I feel like, you know, you say that like it's an AI internal server, but if you can access it on your phone or remotely, then it's not completely, I feel like nothing anymore is completely internal. you know, the dark web has these insane neural networks and large language models, Worm GPT and Fraud GPT, that are specifically are intended to hack into these things. And if the Department of Justice, like maybe California has a beef with ICE, like I totally get that, but if the Department of Justice were to send a subpoena, they have facial recognition, and that would tag everybody in the background of that. And it just has this, the implications, like once you save data, you lose all control over it. You know, any autonomy that you had with that data, it exists, you know? And like once it exists and it's saved, you don't control it. Like there was that Eufy, I think, had a robot vacuum that, you know, they kept their stuff internal. And this woman found a picture of herself on the toilet on the internet because this little robot vacuum had took it and it uploaded it to the internal server, and they thought it was funny and they shared it around. And then next thing she knew, like there's her in the bathroom on the internet, and it never should have happened. And so it scares me a bit how much like potential there is to really lose track of this. You know, like if you, gosh, that clock is intimidating. You know, we say that we're not gonna do surveillance, but that's such a slippery slope, you know? And it's, once you open that box, it's nearly impossible to shut. Like you can't go into my yard without a warrant, but there's no warrant for airspace. So technically you could kind of like get around that warrant, and there's Sonoma County and Costa Mesa and all these other cities that are the ACLU that's suing all of the cities that are using these drones currently. And I just feel like there's so much more investigation, you know? My time is up and now I'm going negative. So, but
yeah, can you wrap it up, please?
But, you know, just from like a development standpoint, and I look at like how that is stored, and like, okay, so we're not going to have facial recognition, but the federal government has facial recognition, and like maybe you're focused on this guy, but it automatically tags every single person in the background.
Okay, I think we've got, you know, your concern.
Yeah, okay, thanks.
All right, thank you very much. Anybody else wishing to speak on this item? Okay, seeing that, I'm going to bring it back. I'm going to ask my questions. Chief, is there an altitude minimum and or maximum for safety purposes, but minimum in the sense that, I mean, if you are at an active crime scene, somebody's holed up in a house, I mean, can you get as low as you need? And you're flying over the neighborhood to get there, can you be at 20 feet? You know?
Yes, that's a good question. There are minimums, there are maximums. However, like we were talking about earlier, when it comes to some of the emergent situations, if you kind of hit the nail on the head when, you know, if we have somebody that's hiding in a backyard and perhaps in a shed or something, you know, those elevations are going to be a moot point at that point. However, the maximums, we do want to adhere to that. But to answer your question, yes, there are minimum maximums. However, during emergent situations, we'll have to probably, especially the lower elevations.
Okay. I was a little confused by your response to Councilmember Peake's question regarding if it's streaming or not as you going somewhere, because I thought you were saying, you know, wouldn't be streaming, but I assume it's streaming back to the pilot because they got to be able to see where the hell they're going.
The way I interpreted the question is whether or not the camera would have to be on during flight, all flight. Like if it's in the air, then the camera's on. That's not necessarily the case. We're not always, the camera's not always on. The camera's not always recording. The flight path doesn't have to have the camera on. Does that make sense?
Then how does the pilot, I mean, I thought this is like a first person view where the pilot is flying this based on what he's seeing.
Right. I guess what I'm referring to is the recording mechanism.
So he's seeing it, but it's not recording is what you're saying.
That's a guess. That's
and, capable. And so what happens is you're responding to an incident somewhere and you're flying over this neighborhood and okay, you're going to ignore the people, you know, in the hot tub, but let's say you're flying over and on the way, okay, there you see illegal activity happening in this person's yard, but that's not where you were going. You know, you were going to that yard that's right, 10 houses away, but you see, oh my gosh, you know, these guys are, I don't know, they're doing something blatantly illegal in their backyard. Is this a matter of you ignore that because that wasn't what you were there for?
So I think it's important to remember that we're not introducing a drone as a first responder. So we're going to be deploying a drone on site.
There's going to be, I can't necessarily think of an instance where we're going to be responding from point A to point B, point B being the area that we're trying to observe. We're going to be basically deploying it from that area. Regarding seeing something, if we see something in flight, we're not necessarily going to ignore it. It'd be extremely rare, but that's the way case law is currently now as well. If I'm in a place that I legally can be and I happen to see something that's illegal, then I can act on it. What I can commit to is that we're not looking for those things. But I certainly can tell you that if obvious illegal activity is taking place, then we'll address that.
Okay. And then, these are so common nowadays that they don't strike me as military equipment, but you're including it in this, annual report. Yes. Is that because there's a state definition that says they are, regardless of that they're just commercially available products?
That's exactly right. Okay. It's outlined as being needed to be on the list.
Got it. Okay, and then Councilmember Peak asked about, they gave the example of fire, and I think that comes to our mind. Also, Public Works might want to put this up during floods. Is the long-term idea that they would have trained pilots, or is it a function of they would have to ask you, the police department, to put it, put this thing up in the air?
So with the fire department, it's easier because we're going to be at that command post anyway. So we're going to be able to respond to a command post, and then in conjunction with what the fire department's needs are, we can deploy and we can have an officer pilot with the guidance and following the needs of the fire department. And then we can look at that program and then determine whether or not it needs to be expanded. So in other words, hey, this is such a great thing that maybe we do need to have pilots in the fire department, and they can have their own program. But right now it'll be a pilot program. Pun intended.
And so, then down the road, what if community development wanted to look in somebody's backyard over a case of hoarding?
I've had a discussion with the director of Public Works, and this is not a drone that would be utilized for Public Works simply because it's not the right type of drone. It wouldn't make sense to have an on-duty police officer respond, to help, with checking algae levels in the lake or something of that nature. So right now we're not looking at a program that would include this drone and these pilots for that.
Down the road, we might look and say, if they need to put something up on January 9th, 2023 to observe flood conditions at multiple places quickly around the city, we could visualize how to get there. We don't have to discuss that this evening. Okay. All right. Thank you. All right. Well, thank you for answering those questions. And does any member of the council want to discuss this further? Or because otherwise we have two recommendations before us.
I'd like to follow up on something that she asked about the potential for basically the server to get hacked the way I'm kind of, you said it's internal. She's worried that stuff can get out, like the example that she gave. And I imagine that this is not going to be something that you can access from your phone or from another computer from the outside the building. Am I correct on that? I imagine it's gonna be very secure.
And this is obviously not my area of expertise, but there are, security set in place. It's evidentiary in nature, if it's marked as evidence, obviously, but there are gonna be some very serious security measures put in place.
That's what I figured. Okay, thank you.
I think the fear is, by certainly speaker and members of the public, is anything is hackable nowadays. But we just do our best, with the latest. We rely on our IT folks to do the latest and be cognizant of, and I'm obviously be watchful that, okay, was some other agency hacked with this type of data somewhere else? How do we, make it harder to hack ours? So, okay, we have two recommendations before us: to approve the drone program, or the UAS program, and to adopt the military equipment policy changes and to approve the report, the annual report. Any further discussion, or do we have a motion?
Yeah, I do have a further discussion, if you will, since this is a new thing for us. One is I wanted to better understand how this is used. You mentioned it being a drone from another agency being used with one of the No Kings protests. How it is used in monitoring events of that nature, where there's not an expectation of criminal activity.
Yeah, specifically in that one, we coordinated with the event organizers, and we were in constant contact with them, and they would call us, and they, you know, they would let us know what was happening and where they thought they needed a call for service. We only had so many officers that could respond. So if they saw somebody that was carrying a bag that they thought was suspicious, you know, because this is a, you know, an event that had a lot of people, they would call us, and then we would fly over, and that would get eyes on. And we, our area of operation was here at Sunken Garden. Mm-hmm. So we were already here. So our response flight path was immediate. And that was allowed us to the amount of time that would have taken a ground officer to get through the crowd, to get to where that person was, to identify whether that bag was suspicious or not, you know, would have been a lot of time. Whereas we were finding one of the advantages in that particular event was we were able to get eyes on in seconds, not even minutes. I mean, not less than a minute.
Okay, thank you. And then I'm a little confused about how this works in emergency management situations, given that you know, where you might be wanting to monitor, say, evacuation traffic or some other sort of thing like that. Where does the feed go to, and where physically, where would the officer be who's piloting? Where's your visual observer, and who gets the feed?
So we're going to set up the program that the officer's most likely going to be at a command post or a forward observing position. In other words, they're going to be in a position of advantage because they might need to be outside of the command post or in the command post themselves. And then they're the ones who are going to be able to see the immediate feed on their device. And then we're going to set up the device to be able to feed back to an emergency operations center so that the people in the emergency operations center can see that live feed as well.
Okay, so in the event of a major wildfire or something, that the drone, the officer controlling it would be out somewhere in the field, okay, in the middle of things, but the command center would get a feed that so they could use to determine, you know, where's traffic getting held up in, you know, on which streets need traffic support, you know, where, what's the next intersection that really needs somebody.
And I can tell you, it's incredibly valuable. You know, it's like saying a picture's worth a thousand words. It truly is. You know, when you're seeing these live feeds and you're in a command post and you're trying to make a determination on what decisions to make, when you get a chance to actually see the impact that things like, you know, traffic or whatever are taking place, it allows your decision-making process to also be cut down in time as well.
Great. It's from a discussion perspective, one of the concerns that I've had as I've watched how other agencies have responded in, you know, huge wildfire disaster situations, a fast-moving disaster, you know, the information is moving too fast for the person who actually has to make the decisions, so that other people have much better information than, you know, the fire chief or whoever it is that's trying to decide how everything is done, you know, and the folks, you know, the police dispatchers or other folks would have better information. This seems to me like this would equalize that and allow our commanders to handle a lot of emergency situations with a lot more safety.
Safety and speed of information.
Yeah. And then, so I'm comfortable with moving ahead with this for now. I will be looking at the report that you bring a year from now, so that with the expectation that we'll have a really thoughtful discussion about those issues of how has this worked, how is it being used, have there been issues where data security seems to be at question, even though this is being started locally, and make sure we're trying to stay as ahead of this as we can in using what could be a really valuable tool in a number of circumstances.
Absolutely.
If there is not other discussion, I'm prepared to make a motion that we approve the staff recommendation as the mayor just outlined.
All right, thank you. So that's recommendations 1 and 2, and I have a second.
Prior to the motion, I just want to invite the mayor to formally close the public hearing.
Yes, so we'll close the public hearing at this point, and we're proceeding to a motion. We have a motion. Do we have a second?
I'll second.
Okay, any further discussion? Seeing none, we have a motion by Councilmember Funk, a second by Mayor Pro Tem Darras. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Funk?
Yes.